Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. I will also heal Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee, Mel. Mel and Dick, I try to be the net controls for this meeting of people for their favorite subject, ham radio. I've been going on now for, let's see, 1982 and now 29 years and about a month. This will be TechNet number 1370 of the issue of the series that began way back in September of 1982. The main subject discussed is ham radio, but quite often we range a little bit far and wide beyond that. People who sign in during the first hour, we make a sincere attempt to answer their questions at least briefly during the first hour. At the end of that hour, mail is available, we'll go to the mailbag, and if not, we'll go to the space report from Paul WS2N. After that, all constraints are removed, so to speak, and we discuss many subjects inside of each. It's an opinion of mine that inside of each true ham radio operator, there is a scientist trying to get out. And so a scientist is interested in anything to do with physics, electronics, chemistry, biology, whatever. Want to know what is Mother Nature really saying and how do things work and how to make them work better. There are people who don't enjoy those particular subjects, the so-called deeper subjects. Be warned ahead of time that in the next few hours after the first hour, that will be discussed. If that kind of subject matter displeases you, recognize that your 2-meter handy talkie has got a modern-day synthesized one. It's got 800 channels. You can tune to one of the 790 other channels, if you know what I mean. You will sometimes hear people who do disruptive things on repeaters. It's easy to get angry at that person. Easy to start addressing him. We usually ignore those, and we try to go on as if nothing has happened. What's really happening with the person who's doing disruptive material is that for some reason he's unhappy with his life. He hears other people enjoying what they're doing, exchanging ideas, and he thinks if he stops them from enjoying it that he's going to get more enjoyment. It's a foolish response. After a certain period of time, I'd like to believe that person will realize that he can't brag about that to his friends. There's no real percentage in that. So instead of being angry at that person, we should feel sorry for them. It's the sign of the times. You can listen to repeaters in London, Chicago, San Francisco, Dallas, and you'll hear disruptive activities. Not so much in Dallas, though. Let me drop them for a second. The ham radio operators in Dallas have assembled an extremely good fox hunting crew, and they're very good at zeroing in on disruptors. And I've heard stories of them zeroing in on one who was mobile and had an encounter on the streets, and in no short order they used some physical techniques to convince the person he really shouldn't continue doing that. And so there's very little jamming that takes place on the Dallas repeaters. There's probably a lesson to be learned there, although it's a slightly more severe way of doing things, the Texas technique. Alrighty. A person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or a comment. He gives his call letters, his name, and the word yes, which means he does have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. It's 29 years in the tri-state area. We believe people are listening. And that's another thing I should mention. There's a lot of brain power in that New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area that we try to tap into. A typical sign-in would sound like this, N2ATG, Dave and Yes. So give me your call letters and your name right now. K2LIW listening.
KB2MAR, Gabe. Quick question.
Gabe recognized. Anyone else?
KZ2WGB, John. Yes, after Paul if you wished it.
Okay. And if there's if we have very few sign-ins between now and then, you might even get moved up on the list there, John. John, one of our very frequent sign-ins. The person who also takes over when I'm out of electricity during Hurricane Irene. Alrighty, we've got Gabe and John. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
K2TGW, Les.
Okay, Les, and Les, that is a yes because you do have a question or a comment? Okay, lesson up. So we've got three so far. Got at least one more vacancy. Anyone else want to sign in because they do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now. Hello? I heard a hello. Go ahead and give me your call letters and name, sir. Okay, let's start off with Gabe first. KB2MAR. Have I got my call letters written correctly? You got it, Gabe. And it doesn't have to be quick. You're allowed to ask whatever you want. You got it, Gabe. K2RW, KB2MAR.
Well, basically, I have a question regarding the mile markers for tomorrow's parade from 45th to 72nd Street, and also any active repeaters involved in the communications for that situation. KB2MAR back to net, if anyone knows on frequency, back to net.
You didn't say, Gabe, but I presume you're talking about New York City Marathon, and is that tomorrow? Give us a little bit of the context. So between 45th and 72nd Street, the mile markers you're asking about, I presume that's going up First Avenue, and I think you're talking about New York City Marathon. Back to you for some fill-in information there, Gabe. KB2MAR, K2RIW in the tech net.
So basically I was referring to the Columbus Day Parade tomorrow on 5th Avenue from 45th to 72nd. Just curious if anyone on frequency have any active repeaters involved in the communications and mile markers and things like that. Back to net.
Dick, you might want to throw that to YDT if he's out there, Matt.
Let's see if Matt's out there. YDT, go right ahead. Okay, do we have anyone on frequency with knowledge of the Columbus Day Parade tomorrow? The radio communication is going to take place, the mile markers and whatever. Anyone with any information about the Columbus Day Parade, please give us your call letters and name right now. Hey, you did say, Gabe, it's going to be a brief one. looks like you stumped the crowd. It looks like you get the prize, so to speak. Gabe, maybe not everyone has tuned in yet, so to speak. You're allowed to re-ask your question again later on in the TechNet, because I'm not sure we've got an answer for you right now. KB2MAR to take it with a little bit of delay, in case anyone else does have some info about the Columbus Day Parade. K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Gabe, and I'm afraid to say you've stumped us. You've asked a question that we don't seem to have an answer for, Gabe. You get the prize.
QSL. No problem. I mean, that can always come on up with a half hour, 45 minutes or so. Maybe before you get into the deep subjects, I can ask again. I can do that. KB2MAR back to net.
Yes, I recommend you do that, Gabe. Right. You're allowed to ask again. Let's hope that somebody with a little more smarts on that particular subject shows up. Now, John feels that he's got a fairly deep subject. I'm going to skip over John temporarily and go over to Les. Les, K2TGW. Haven't heard from you in a while. Hope they're treating you well. And go right ahead with your question. You can take your own sweet time. We've got very few so far in the early section tonight. You've got it, Les.
All right, K2TGW. It's a fairly simple question. I have been fooling around with a little bit of V-Star. I have an Alinco 2-meter antenna, all-mode antenna. And it works, I mean, amplifier. Small brick, does about 35 watts, 5-in. Question is, when I'm doing D-Star amplification, what am I doing? AM, FM, sideband? My presumption is it's some form of FM. Correct or not, Dick?
Yeah, since all the D-Star equipment I've seen seems to be a function that you add to or is connected with FM rigs. I'd like to believe it's all FM. And again, I think there are some all-mode rigs that have got DSTAR. All-mode rigs have got a kind of amplitude capability. Single sideband is a kind of amplitude capability. So let's see if we got a DSTAR expert out there. This is not one of my areas of strong information. So whoever knows anything about DSTAR, is the protocol of DSTAR primarily FM modulation? If so, Gabe's amplifier is the Linko amplifier, which was probably made for FM, will handle it very nicely. When it comes to these afterburner amplifiers, and lots of guys have taken an afterburner, like say for instance the Mirage Baker 1016, which is primarily intended for FM service, and you put single sideband through there, and it comes out with moderate performance, but there's a bit of splatter. It's not really a purely linear amplifier unless you do some modification to the biasing network to make it more into a linear amplifier as opposed to a Class C. So anybody who knows anything about DSTAR, is it primarily FM and its modulation, please give us your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. My goodness. Hey, hey, Les, we're batting 1,000 tonight. 1,000 minus 1, if you know what I mean. 1 minus 1,000. Looks like we're not getting an answer for you. You're going to have to ask your question again. One more try. Anybody know anything about DSTAR? Is the modulation of DSTAR primarily FM? Give me your call letters right now.
W2CH.
Whiskey 2, Giant Charlie Hotel. Please start up with your name, sir, and tell us anything. We're having our problems here. You got it, Mr. CH. What's your name, sir?
Yes, Dick. Good evening. Nanette, the name here is Ray, Romeo Alpha Yankee in White Plains. The rig I'm on right now is an ICOM D-Star 880H. And as far as I know from the primary bands, 2 meters UHF in the 440 and 1.2 gigahertz, it's FM in the digital voice mode. So this rig will work analog or digital FM. As far as anything else in a different mode, I don't know. But from being on for about a year now and what I know, that's primarily. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet, W2CH.
QGZ.
Thank you very much, Ray. And Mr. QGZ, William, help us out here. Hope you know something about DSTAR. Those smart guys in Massapequa, they normally know things. WB2QGZ. You got it, William.
Hey, good evening. WB2QGZ. Don't have much more than it's a TDMA mode. That's it. As far as the individual modulation or what they call it, I'm not 100% sure, but it's TDMA.
Huh. Alrighty. You got frequency division, multiple access, time division, multiple access. In the case of time division, multiple access protocols, which I think a few of the cell sites use that kind, or something similar to it, each individual user is given a certain time slot within a frame, and that frame is repeated X number of times per second. So each individual user transmits his packet of information during that time slot. With reference to TDMA that's used on cell sites, Bill, which is where an area which I think you've got a fair amount of exposure, experience. Tell us how, what do you believe, what percentage of the cell companies these days, cell protocols, are using TDMA? And am I correct in saying that there's a repetitive frame, and within that frame, each individual user has a particular time slot in the TDMA system? WB2QGZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
WB2QGZ. Well, Sprint and Excel's soon to be turned off IDEN network, which is currently residing at 800 megahertz, and 900 for that matter, is TDMA. It can support on a single RF channel 25 kilohertz bandwidth, give or take. Three simultaneous phone calls, six simultaneous direct connect two-way radio style calls, or up to 12 low-speed datas, or you can gang those time slots up and make higher-speed data. My recollection is GSM, which is used by AT&T and T-Mobile, is a form of TDMA, but I don't really work with that every day, so I'm not 100% sure. I'm just looking here to see if there's any info on emission designators here for D-Star. I'm going to have to dig around a little bit here and have a look, but it's not really a multiplex thing. We have a whole bunch of different conversations cooking at once. It just seems to be they're packaging up some data, some voice packets, and some other stuff so that you can have a stream of low-speed data accompanying your voice, and a couple other things can go on at once, some overhead, so that it allows you to have your radio can be located by another radio independent of being on somebody's individual repeater. You can travel to another area of the country, and it'll find you through the overhead that it muxes up in the data. Go ahead.
One of the things I'm curious about is that how popular is D-Star? Are 1% of the repeater ham radio users using D-Star? Is it increasing in popularity? Are more rigs coming out with it? Is it an option you have to buy, or is it already there and you just turn it on when you read the right portion of the manual? Anybody who knows anything about D-Star along these lines, popularity, how do you use it, how do you add it, is it difficult to add, is there a module you have to add, or is it automatically built into rigs that have the capability? Anything along these lines, if you've got some smarts, please give us your call letters right now. I'd like to know more about it. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2CH again.
Go right ahead, Ray.
Yes, Dick. Well, the D-Star mode is a proprietary mode. There's a module, I forget the name that they call it, but it came out of the JARL in Japan, where they run them on UHF primarily, and it's only so far being made by ICOM. I don't know if there's Kenwood in some Japanese equipment for Kenwood has it, but yes, there is data. There is a higher speed data at the 1.2 gigahertz, and you can do a data type thing with DRADS, which is a type of communication with messages that is another feature of D-Star. But so far, that's why no other manufacturers have it. There are, if you look on Wikipedia on D-Star, there are some other people who have devised it to work in their own equipment, but that's not regularly used. K2RIW, W2CH.
I'm looking at the front panel of my Kenwood. I happen to be looking at a TR-851 right now, but I think the 751 also has it. Make sure I'm not transmitting out of another rig in the house. I see on the upper right-hand corner something called DCL. And I presume on that Kenwood rig, DCL is not D-Star. You think I'm correct on that one, Ray? Go ahead.
N2RDB.
Oh, okay, I just was going to say, no, the 751, I think I had that rig years ago. That's not a D-Star. That might be something else digital, but I know there's a voice module for that rig, but no, that would not be Dick. Other station, go ahead, please.
N2RDB, please start up with your call letters, and with your name, sir, and tell us anything you It's Timothy. Go ahead, Tim. Tell us what you know about it.
And I have a question also after this.
D-Star is around. It's not going to vanish anytime soon. It seems to be gaining a foothold, albeit more slowly than some people, including myself, would like to see. I own a D-Star radio. It's absolutely awesome what you can do with these things. And most of the ICOM radios that I've seen, I can't say this for all of them, you have to buy an extra module, and it's usually advisable to do so when you buy the radio. That way the factory puts it in for you. In fact, I think, but I'm not 100% certain, that it has to be factory installed. You know, either that or you'd better prepare to have some ESD protection, such as a mat and a wrist strap when you go to install the thing. I think that's the kind of a job it is. As I said, I own a D-Star radio. I own an ICOM IC91AD, which now is still around, but is no longer offered with the D-Star option. It's an analog-only radio. I'll let it drop for a moment.
W2CH with additional comments.
Bad QGZ with some more, too.
Yes, station's recognized. Anyway, I own the IC91AD. If you're going to only have an HT and D-Star, you'll be somewhat disappointed, because there aren't yet that many repeaters around. That is in the process of being changed here in Nassau County. That's all I'm going to say. But anyway, it's a good radio, but it has a couple of drawbacks. Namely, it has two power settings, 5 watts or a half a watt. Why they did that, it's unfathomable. And also, when you're operating the radio in digital voice mode at the 5-watt setting, the back of it gets incredibly warm, almost too warm to handle. And it does suck the life out of your battery. Also, I've worked with some of the mobile rigs. I've tried them out, and I was really quite impressed with what they can do. And even through an HT, you can actually be carrying on a voice conversation, and with the right cabling, actually sending a text message or a small file. Like I say, with that HT, it runs kind of warm, so I wouldn't advise doing that on a regular basis. But if you have a mobile rig, or you're using a mobile as a base station, or what have you, if you have one of those 1.2 gigahertz rigs, then you'd be all set. N2 RDB.
Now, we've got Ray and Bill and Wesley with some further information questions, but Tim, you said something that's kind of exciting. You said it's really awesome what it can do, D-Star. Give us an example of something you did with D-Star, or you know of someone doing with D-Star, that struck you as kind of neat and sophisticated and awesome. Give us a quick description of what impressed you with D-Star. You got it, Tim.
The thing that impressed me the most with D-Star was that using an HT hooked up to my house antenna, hitting a repeater in the city on the 70-centimeter band, I was able to carry on a QSO with a bunch of my friends while at the same time we were sending text messages and low-res photos back and forth to each other. And while this was going on, in comes a guy from Japan on the gateway, N2 RDB. I think that's pretty awesome.
I have a problem with 77 meter wavelength.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. That does sound like exciting stuff. In other words, you had some of the characteristics of slow scan television. You guys were sending text and pictures to each other at the exact same time you were talking to each other. It's almost like ham radio television. Am I correct in that assumption there, Tim? Back to you, Tim.
There is, of course, some time slicing, time sharing going on, but yes. Essentially, we were doing those things at the same time. And the gateway function is, that's a lot like IRLP or Echolink, but it's awesome how you can do that, and you can actually see the call sign of who's coming in. It comes up on your display if, of course, they have their radio properly programmed. There's a whole setup menu you go through into RDB.
Thank you, Tim. Lots of information. Wesley, you had a question about 70 centimeters, and by the way, many guys, when they say 70 centimeters, if it's a single sideband type guy, it means 432. If it's an FM guy, it means between 440 and 450 megacycles FM. All of that is lumped together and called 70 centimeters, that particular band. It's really 69 and a fraction, but you know what I mean. They round things off. N2XJN with the further details of that question. K2RAW, go ahead, Wes.
N2XJN, no, I've heard 77 meters. So I said, what? 70 centimeters, I just didn't hear properly. Okay, it hurts. You're not going to be able to see all of the call signs, and you will definitely not be able to see the call sign of the people from the hotspots or secondary nodes. N2XJN.
Okay, that's additional information. We've got both Ray and Bill. Whiskey 2, Charlie Hotel. If I wrote my call in is right. Yes, go ahead. You got it, Ray.
Okay, fine, Dick. Yes, W2CH is the call. And as far as the D-Star, I was going to get back to the equipment that some of them have it optional, like the 2820, which is a dual band rig, is about $600, 50 watts per band, and it's another 200, something close to 300, for the GPS D-Star module. Now, this rig came with D-Star built in. This is the successor to the 800, and the 8ADH did come with it. It's in the upper $400 price. And the 1.2 gigahertz one, I don't know much about, haven't used anything in that band. That was originally what came out as their first, I think one of their first rigs, and has a higher speed data. And then the HTs, yes, the 92AD has replaced the 91. I think that's with D-Star built in. Also repeater-wise, yes, they're around the city, a few repeaters, New Jersey, VHF, UHF, a couple up here, and let me drop it. And the way I program it with the RT Systems programming, there is a gateway, there's a calculator, D-Star calculator, that lets you set up a path discussing about it. It does identify you as far as your name or other inputs or the rig you're on. A few details do come up on the screen, almost like an RDS on FM broadcast. And also, you can put a path into a foreign country. I've worked in New Zealand station a couple of times on the repeater in Brooklyn. And so those are some of the things you can do to link up, like K2RB there did point out, with these distant contacts that you can create a path to. What you do is you register on a gateway when you first get into D-Star, and then you can access the system that way if the repeater has a gateway to it. And that's all part of the programming system. There are also some YouTube videos on D-Star, too, that might be helpful to people if you Google that. K2RIWW2CH, and then.
That's some nice information you've given us there, Ray. You've got a good clean signal and a nice clean audio, but your audio is a little bit lower than it should be. So when you get a chance, next time you're at one of the Limar get-togethers where Andy DeVay2CDL comes with his tune-up clinic, You could use a little bit more audio, and we'd hear you a little louder. But Chuck, you sound good. Thank you for that information. I'm getting the impression real fast that Tim and Ray have had quite a bit of enjoyment with their D-Star equipment. Bill's the next person with some further information, and I wonder how many QSOs you've made with D-Star, or what you've heard people doing with it. So tell us your experience with it, Bill. WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, WB2QGZ. I do not yet have a D-Star radio that may change shortly. I'm not sure if Tim and I are talking about the same things, but I suspect there may be a VHF and a UHF D-Star presence before too long in Nassau. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. But I think the original question was kind of like, can I use my particular amp with this particular mode? And in that direction, what I have is it looks like the voice is an 8 kilobit circuit. It uses what's referred to as GMSK, Golf Mike Sierra Kilo. And that's how it moves its voice. And it's sort of similar, if you're familiar at all with the, similar to the Moto Turbo type gear with regard to duty cycle and stuff. So in other words, my experience with that has been some FM amps have worked and some FM amps have not worked. So there may be something individual to look out for when you try to push a GMSK through an amplifier. That's about all I have. WB2Q, GZ.
Okay.
KC2OJO.
KC2OJO recognized. But what you just said, Bill, leads me to believe that it's not just purely angular modulation. I mean, if the amplifier is being used in a Class C mode, simply being driven or not driven with a carrier that's on or off, and during the time the carrier is there, angular modulation takes place. To put it in engineering terms, it means either AM or FM, FM or phase modulation, angular modulation as opposed to linear amplitude modulation. So you seem to be saying that you have some evidence, Bill, that some amplifiers have trouble with D-Star. In other words, the rig by itself reproduces D-Star very nicely. Add an afterburner, and some grief occurs. I wonder, give us a couple more words on do you know of a particular person who has added an amplifier and the D-Star stopped working because the amplifier itself was being asked to do something more than Class C amplification with angular modulation? WB2QGZ, K2RIW.
Okay, no first-hand experience with D-Star. Only experience with it's not the same. It's a similar TDMA two-way mode that Motorola uses. And they call that Moto Turbo. And from that, only anecdotal evidence of, hey, I bought this amp for my repeater and it didn't work properly. Don't know why it didn't work properly. But, you know, this other amp did. Or I, you know, went to TPL and ordered a, what they refer to as digital compatible amplifier or something like that. So, no actual hands on the hardware, just, you know, sort of phone calls for support a little bit, and that was about it. So no particular brands or anything else. I never got that deep.
Very fine, Bill. KC2, Oscar, Juliet, Oscar. Please start off with your name, sir, and tell us anything you know about D-Star and amplifiers. You got it, Mr. OJO.
The name is Howard, and I think it was about 2 AmFests ago at Weimark, Kings County Repeater Association set up a booth, and at that booth they featured D-Star information. One of the gentlemen there was very, very familiar with D-Star, and at that point I learned several things. First of all, you can buy a D-Star dongle. I don't think it's called that, but if you go up on the internet or Google it, you'll find out that you can buy a little box for $200 that will allow you to use your PC with freeware software and enter the D-Star gateways and repeater systems. I'm going to drop for a second. Also, the other thing that was very interesting is that the Kings County Repeater Association does have a D-Star repeater. It is not with D-Star equipment. They use some PC boards that are also available through the internet. I believe they come from Europe, and some free software again. And as long as you have a wideband FM, that may be where the amplifier makes a difference. This particular chap said that ordinary narrow band, and I don't know if he's talking the difference between 5 kilohertz or 10 kilohertz, but evidently the bandwidth is important. And he also stated that pretty much D-Star is a packet system with a forward error correction. Those are the comments that I got from the booth at the Weimar Hamfest from the Kings County Repeater Association.
Thank you, Howard. Some more good information. Howard, also, you've got a nice clean signal going into the repeater. I'm hearing you on the input. A nice clean audio, but your audio could be a little bit louder. So again, next time there's one of those tune-up clinics with a little bit more audio, the guy in his mobile with road noise would hear you a little bit better. Good sounding rig, though. Thank you for that extra information. When it comes to the...
Dick, it'd be kind of hard for him to adjust my audio in another room from where the shack is, working through Skype, a bunch of attenuators, two PCs, and then finally into the radio. It can drive you crazy to really get things adjusted exactly right. Hopefully I'm close enough that I'm not sure I want to mess with it anymore.
Very well done, Howard. Wow. You've got quite a system there. Okay. There are people who have tried to do what you're doing and have had quite a bit of trouble. Howard's last name is Stern, Howard Stern. And guaranteed people have asked you about that. Give us a couple of words on what people say when they find out that your full name is Howard Stern. KC2OJO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, actually, now it's not a bother. I happen to have short hair, and I'm short myself. And if somebody has a comment, I just tell them, well, I just don't have my stilts and my wig on. And if I did, I'd give them my autograph. But the worst thing that happened was when Howard Stern was in Washington as a disc jockey, I was visiting a Navy facility. And when they saw my license, the gal at the security started giggling. And, you know, you wonder, what's wrong? What did I say? What did I do? Did I not zip myself up? What's going on? And finally, I saw somebody, and the secretary told me, oh, we have Howard Stern up here, and boy, you should hear what he says. He just accused Al Haig of being a homosexual with Ronald Reagan over the radio. So now it's okay.
Guarantee you've got some interesting stories, particularly if you're visiting secure government facilities and people temporarily confuse you with the on the radio Howard Stern. Well done. So I'm getting the impression, Les, who asked the original question, I don't think your amplifier is going to be a problem. Where Howard thought there could be a problem with bandwidth, most of these afterburner amplifiers are made to cover the whole Don 2-meter band, 144 to 148. So they're at least 4 megahertz wide. I'm having trouble believing that the bandwidth of the amplifier could be a grief. The bandwidth of the final stage of the transmitter trying to reproduce the data itself, that's a separate issue. But
I think your amplifier is going to do the job. But as you can tell, we're not positive we've got the whole story here. As I see it, Les, you're pushing the limits of our ability here of a real experience that we normally claim we've got on the TechNet. K2TGW, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead. you know who you are.
No, it's still Les. All right, I give you a little more and a little less. That's L-E-S-S. I also have a 91 AD. I use it on 2 meter and 440 D-Star. I can get into repeaters. I get into the 2 meter repeaters, but then I need the Linko amp that works. There are a number of 440 repeaters, one of which is now in Brooklyn, that is easy to get into. And we have one that will be up in Westbury shortly. My name is on that list. That's the reason why I know about it. They needed 10 people with D-Star capabilities. I was one of those people. I was just wondering, because I would like to be able to get into some of the New York City or New Jersey repeaters on 440, and I knew I would need an amp. I need something more than a 5 watts I'm running. So I guess basically guessing the idea that I can get one of those Mirage or KLM amps 5 watts in and 40, 40, 50, 60 watts out, which was going to be more than enough. And it will work, since I do, as I said before, that 2-meter Elenco, which works perfectly well with my 91 AD. All right. You've allayed some of my fears, but not totally. Maybe next time. Thank you, Dick. K2TGW.
Now, Les, you live in Woodmere, which is nice and close by my standards to the five boroughs of New York City. And you're worrying about 5 watts versus 50 watts versus even higher power in order to get good coverage on the so-called 450 band, the 70 centimeter band, into these D-Star capable repeaters in New York City. Tell us a couple of words, Les. Your antenna is what kind? How many feet above the ground? And if I was standing in the middle of your antenna and I looked toward New York City, what kind of terrain would I see? Would I be looking into a bunch of buildings, a hill, or would I have line of sight and see Empire State Building in the background? K2TGW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, it's fairly simple. I have a J-pole, and the apex of it must be close to 50 feet. It's up on top of the chimney and then well above it from some bracketing further up. So that, my problem is not that. Can it see New York City? I guess between the buildings, you know, I guess it will see. I could most likely see further than that if I stood by the top of the antenna, but I'd be darned if I'm going to stand up that high. I don't like heights. I have no problem. The only problem is only 5 watts into New Jersey doesn't always work. And the D-Star antennas that are on the Empire State Building, from what I've been told, are on the other side. They are favoring New Jersey, but then again, the people who put them up live in New Jersey. So, hence the reasoning for that, or so I was told. But I can get into all the nets, and that's Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, between 7 and 8. I have no problem getting into the 440 ones that I can get via the station in Brooklyn, or the repeater in Brooklyn. I don't really remember what it is, but it's 445.4750, down 5, and D-Star. So it works. And the 2-meter repeater, as I said before, with the 35-40 watts that I can shove out with the Elenco, I can get into many of the other ones. It's interesting. It's not the living end, but if you're going to have a second HT, not a bad bet. Tim, I don't find it a problem, especially with this. I bought it inexpensively. This is K2TGW, Dick.
Quite good, Les. Thank you for all the information. And Les, I invite you to come back periodically as you use the system more, as you add that afterburner on your 70-centimeter system, as you communicate with more of these people, and you can come back and give us the war stories of who you talked to, what kind of pictures you sent, what kind of internet traffic you were handling, and so on. So come back, please, periodically and tell us how it goes. You're ahead of the crowd, as I see it. I think the percentage of people right now using D-Star is by my standards, relatively small. And from what I'm hearing, it sounds like it quite possibly is going to be increasing in popularity. I think we've gone through the list of everyone except John. Did I forget somebody?
Wesley.
Yeah, you had a question on the subjects that we've discussed so far? Wes, go ahead.
No, I wanted to be added to the list of questions. I believe that I have a kind of easy question about antennas.
Understand. Okay, we haven't hit the 9 o'clock period yet, so John, why don't we go to your question? KC2WGB. K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Mel, I'd like you and Mel to maybe help me out with an explanation. I'd like to know what happens to the propagation pattern and the tuning of an antenna when I take a piece of wire, which is approximately, say, 7 feet long, let's say it's 2 meters, and I wind that up as a helix coil on a fiberglass rod. Say the spacing between the windings is a quarter of an inch. What would be the effect of that?
Okay, if I understand correctly, you're taking an antenna which ordinarily is, let's say, a quarter wave ground plane, if I understood you correctly, the amount of wire that's normally the quarter wave, and instead of leaving it out straight, you wind it onto a insulated form. I was doing something with the computer at the same time. I was listening to you, not paying attention 100%. I may have misinterpreted you. So run it by one more time. What is the before and what is the after, John? You got it, John.
Okay, Dick. Say a 7-foot length of wire, and I wind it on a fiberglass like a fishing pole, quarter-inch spacing, which will dramatically reduce the length of the antenna physically. The wire length will remain the same. Say quarter-inch spacing between the turns. I'd like to know what exactly takes place when I do that, and what and the propagation pattern effect.
Okay, I'm getting a little bit more of a hint of what you're asking for, and I think you're somewhat worried about the helical mode. In the case of a helix antenna, the so-called axial mode of the helix requires that each individual turn of the helix be very close to one full wavelength in circumference. If each individual turn is one full wavelength in circumference, and then you have anything from almost one turn to as many turns as you want, you then launch the so-called axial mode, which means the main lobe of the signal, the Bohr site, is down the axis of the helix. Whenever the turns are anything smaller in circumference than a full wavelength, then the only way it can radiate is the so-called transverse mode. In other words, the signal comes off at right angles to the axis of the helical winding. So now, when you and I wind a coil at the base of a whip antenna, let's assume now, let me drop. Let's assume I want to put a 20-meter antenna on my automobile, and I'm winding a coil on the bottom because I don't have, let me think now, 16 feet. I'm not going to put a 16-foot whip on the bumper of my car and hope to miss the telephone poles and trees and everything else. I'm going to put something considerably smaller and make up the difference with the coil at the bottom. Now, whenever you make a antenna, like a quarter-wave ground plane, which is typically what you put on a car, when you make it less than a quarter-wave long, or let me start off at a quarter-wave, at exactly a quarter-wave of length, if it had a real great big ground plane, this is an ideal situation, you would see half of 70 ohms, half of the dipole, because the other half of the dipole is the mirror image in your ground plane and your counterpoise. So you'd see something in the vicinity of 35 ohms resistive. As you start making that quarter wave whip radiator a little bit shorter than quarter wave, very rapidly it starts giving you a capacitive reactance. The resistance stays there. The 35 ohms very slowly decreases. It'll go down to 30 and 25 ohms as you start going shorter and shorter. The resistive component stays almost the same, moves very slowly. But the reactive component will take off like a banshee. As you a little bit shorter, it starts to become capacitor reactive. The equivalent circuit with a little bit shorter than a quarter wave long would be something like 30 ohms resistive and maybe 200 ohms capacitor reactance. It'll happen real fast. Therefore, when you put a coil at the base of the antenna, and if you made the coil have an inductive reactance of 200 ohms in my case, you've now canceled the inductive component. You're now just left with the 30 ohm resistive component, and life is a lot easier when it comes to impedance matching. So I know this is in the direction of your question, and maybe it's helping a little bit. Let me drop. So whenever an antenna is not the favored length for that style of antenna, with rare exception, you're going to pick up reactants real fast. And the reason for that is that we all tend to gloss over the fact that radiation is difficult. We'd like to believe that we take this beautiful signal coming out of our transmitter, it goes down the feed line, hits the antenna, and once the signal gets launched onto the antenna, it just simply jumps into space. We want to believe that. Nothing like that happens at all. That signal travels down the wire, and something in the vicinity of 5% of the energy on the first pass radiates into space. And when that energy gets down to the end of the cable, end of the radiator, 90 or 95% of it's still left, it reflects off the end and comes back to you. And depending on whether or not it comes back in phase, out of phase, leading or lagging, is strongly dependent on the length of that radiator. So you now see the mechanism by which a substantial amount of energy is going to come back. If it comes back a little bit early because your antenna is too short, you're going to see that as a capacitor reactance. Early coming back really gives you a leading current, and any kind of a capacitor as a load on your transmitter creates leading current. So now you see where it's coming from, and you can see why it happens real fast. So therefore, whenever you and I do impedance matching, John, 95% of the impedance matching we do is to get rid of the reactive component. That's the one that multiplies real fast, gets real big, gives you a whole lot of standing wave ratio in a hurry. So the big part of your impedance matching network, your antenna tuner, is getting rid of the reactive component and then learning to live with the resistive component, which usually is a hell of a lot easier. That's part of what I think you're asking. Let me drop. And at first I thought you were saying, if I start off with a quarter wavelength of wire and wind it up in a coil, in other words, I'm making a helical radiator as opposed to, by helical I mean it's wound up in a solenoid-like coil, but the turns are much smaller than a wavelength on each turn. So I'm using the transverse mode, not the axial mode. That's the way it's going to radiate. By the way, the radiation you get off the coil and the radiation you get off the wire is fairly similar. In other words, a watts per inch of radiation, watts per inch along the coil and watts per inch along the wire are not that different. There are people who think that the coil doesn't do any radiating, or there are other people who think the coil does all of it. The coil, it is a kind of a slow wave structure. A little bit greater phase shift per inch takes place across the coil, but that doesn't necessarily change the magnitude of the radiation. The magnitude of the radiation is primarily, I think, a function of how much current is flowing through the wire. And the current flowing through the wire of the coil and the current flowing the wire of the radiator section above the coil is not that different. I probably haven't really hit exactly what you're asking for, but maybe this helps a little bit, John. KC2, WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. So then if I follow this right, I don't remember if you said each turn would have to be a full wavelength or a quarter wavelength. At a quarter wavelength, I would have to have a diameter roughly 6 1/4 inches, something like that, on that insulating structure. Is that correct?
Okay, and the place where you wind the coil, if you really want the axial mode, the helix-like radiation, which tends to be circular polarization, each individual turn must have a total circumference of a full wavelength. If each individual turn has a circumference of close to one full wavelength, now you're making a real helical antenna, and the bore side of that antenna will be down the axis of that helical coil. Whenever you wind a coil significantly shorter in circumference than that, quarter wavelength, half wavelength, eighth of a wavelength, circumference per turn, the only real radiation you get is transverse mode. In other words, if that helical coil had an axis straight up, you would be radiating most of your signal toward the horizon, if you know what I mean, off at right angles from the axis of the coil. So, and most of the frequencies on HF bands that you and I talk about, to make each individual turn a full wavelength and circumference would be a pretty massive structure. Almost none of us goes there. Therefore, almost any way you wind the coil, whether you wind it on a big diameter or a small diameter, is your choice. It makes a little bit of difference in the Q and how fast you build up the inductance per turn or inductance per length. But as far as the transverse mode of radiation, the radiation off the side, it doesn't really care very much about the diameter until you start hitting the diameter so big that it's one full wavelength per turn for one circumference, if you know what I mean. One of us a little bit more clear, John. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Okay, because I was doing a few experiments and I was having trouble getting them to tune, and I was fooling with the spacing between the windings, not so much the diameter, but I would have to work more with the diameter, I can see, than the spacing between the turns. I was trying to take that antenna and shorten it from a full wavelength of 2 meters down to about maybe less than 20 inches, but to have it all wound up, but I see now the diameter would have to be too much. So, okay, you've answered my question. Thank you very much.
John, are you familiar with the so-called Brown and Woodward curves? And I could tell you where to find them. These Brown and Woodward curves are two sets of graphs. One graph will tell you what is the resistive component. So first of all, the horizontal axis of the graph is length of the radiator, and the vertical axis is the impedance. One graph tells you the resistive component, another graph tells you the reactive component. The Brown and Woodward curves represent, I think, a man year of work done way back in 1948. And whenever you and I make any kind of a dipole or a ground plane-like antenna, those curves will tell you exactly what impedance you're going to get ahead of time. As such, you know something about how much inductive reactance you're going to have in order to resonate it. You also know that there's a curve, there's a very nice equation in the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where if you know the diameter of your helical winding, your solenoid-like winding, if you know the diameter and the number of turns, it will tell you how many nanohenries or microhenries of inductance you're going to have. And from that and your frequency, you can calculate what amount of inductive reactance it's going to have. And if the Brown and Woodward curve tells you that your shortened antenna is going to have 200 ohms of capacitive reactance, and you want to create 200 ohms of inductive reactance in the coil in order to resonate it, that at your frequency is some number of microhenries. And that that equation in the Radio Amateur's Handbook will tell you how many turns are going to give you that many microhenries. As you make the turns closer together and further apart, you do have, let me pick a number, a 20% or so change in reactance. Let me drop. In other words, if I wind 10 turns and I've got two diameters of the wire spacing between each turn, and I get some number of microhenries for that coil, and now I compress the coil instead of there being two wire diameters between each turn, I compress them so that they're really almost right up against each other. I'm going to get a 20% increase in the reactance and the inductive, in the amount of henries, microhenries, simply because now that all the flux links, all of the turns a little bit better, and therefore the reactance increases. I wonder if that's some of what you're asking for, John, but are you familiar with the Brown and Woodward curves? Because if you're not, I could tell you where to go to see them, and you'd be amazed how many times it'll save quite a few steps in resonating and impedance matching an antenna. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
building the antenna.